Spain beat Argentina 1-0 in extra time to win the 2026 FIFA World Cup at MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. It was a tournament full of drama, upsets, and cultural moments, not least in China, where Xiao Hongshu streamed all 104 matches for free, and Norwegian striker Erling Haaland generated nearly 1.8 billion views on the platform. China's national team, meanwhile, watched from home. Again, Mark Dreyer has spent nearly two decades trying to explain that paradox. Mark is the founder of China Sports Insider, author of Sporting Superpower, an insider's view on China's quest to be the best, and one of the most respected English language journalists covering sport in China. His recent piece in The Economist on the state of Chinese football went viral, laying out why a country with enormous resources, a football-obsessed president, and 1.4 billion people has qualified for the World Cup exactly once, in 2002, and shows few signs of returning anytime soon. In this episode, Mark gives his verdict on the 2026 World Cup, the football, the format, and the final. As a dual English-Canadian citizen, he also has personal stakes in two teams, England, who reached the semifinals before losing to Argentina and finished third with a thrilling 6-4 win over France, and Canada, who bowed out in the round of 16. He breaks down the state of Chinese football at every level, the national team, the domestic league, and the youth development pipeline, and explains why the problems run much deeper than money or political will can fix. Mark also digs into how China consumed this World Cup differently, Xiao Hongshu's landmark streaming deal, the Haaland phenomenon, and what it reveals about how Chinese fans engage with foreign athletes, and whether China will ever host, let alone win, a World Cup of its own. Enjoy.
The Chinese sports broadcasting landscape has long been quite fragmented, and platforms will pop up, sometimes affiliates of parent companies, and suddenly they've got a huge big tournament and no one's ever heard of them before. But it doesn't really matter. It does sort of jump around a bit. And that's been the case probably for about 10 to 15 years. Where there's new apps that will pop up and suddenly they're the major player or they'll go bust or you know, so it's a very fluid landscape, which is actually quite exciting because you've got competition. And so there's lots of people bidding and trying to stream lots of things. So that's a good thing. It's getting it in front of the fans, and the fact that it was free of charge also a positive.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation. Brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Mark, welcome back to the Negotiation Podcast.
Great to be back.
Let's start with the 2026 World Cup as a whole. Spain beat Argentina 1-0 in extra time in the final at MetLife Stadium. What's your overall verdict on the tournament, the football, the format, the atmosphere, and the final outcome?
You know what? The World Cup, and I almost hate to admit it, but the World Cup always delivers. I remember being almost angry before the tournament started just because of the outrageous greed of FIFA and all the stuff with the ticket pricing, even to the point where they were going to charge people at one point for bringing in, you know, couldn't bring in your reusable water bottles so they could charge for bottled water. Just every little detail seemed to be squeezing every ounce of revenue out of the fans. But then, of course, you know, it's similar to an Olympics. There's all these stories before. And then as soon as the sporting action kicks off, we've got other things to talk about. And wow, what a tournament. I mean, it had everything. It had amazing matches. It had controversy, both on and off the pitch. Great teams getting to the latter stages. And a pretty epic final, incredibly one-sided, but, you know, it went down to the wire. Argentina just refused, as they had all tournament, refused to lose, refused to go out. and push. I mean, they were not that far away from penalties. And then who knows?
So as someone with dual English Canadian citizenship, you had a personal stake in two teams at the tournament that did very well. England reached the semifinals before losing 2-1 to Argentina, then beat France 6-4 to finish third. Canada went out in the round of 16, first time they've ever made it that far, losing 3-0 to Morocco. A couple of goals at the end. Let's be honest, Canada was pushing, and that's what happens when you push, is that you give up those chances, and so it happened. It was kind of a 1-0 game. Give us your honest assessment of both performances. Proud, frustrated, or somewhere in between?
I mean, I think that they both got a... Yeah. Neither of them are underachieved, let me put it that way. Like they did about as well as could be expected. You know, if you've ever spoken to English fans, they'll tell you every tournament of how football's coming home. We know deep down that it never will, but, you know, we got to keep talking about it. And so realistically, the semifinals is probably where our team is today. We're not on the level of Spain and France. We could have beaten Argentina. I think that was the frustration because we were up and then the tactics, we just sort of sat back and gave it to them. So there was some frustration there, but still semi-final. Yes, I know we beat France in the third place playoff, but that was a sort of almost like an all-star game, which was quite entertaining. Canada, it's great to see the progress. For me, it's the progress year on year or tournament on tournament that is there. This was a fun tournament for me because I did the Panini sticker book with my son for the first time. My first sticker book, and Panini have been doing this for years and years, was 1986 Mexico, the Mexico World Cup. And Canada, I remember the Canadian page, the Canadian team were in that World Cup. That was the first ever time they'd qualified. Then the next time they qualified was Qatar 4 years ago. Obviously, they qualified by right. And then for this one, they qualified as hosts. But the fact that they qualified for Qatar, they weren't sort of just given a place into this tournament. It does feel that there is momentum building in Canada and Canadian football. And, you know, hopefully they will now be regular qualifiers and they can build on this performance. But I think it does take time. It takes time for the whole culture, for the whole momentum. You know, kids watch this and it takes time for them to then get into the game and then, you know, another 15 years until they're ready for the national team and so on. We've seen something similar on the US side as well, I think. So it's good to see some of those, good to see that progress, but long-term progress. And that, you know, I know we're going to talk about China, but that it's the long-term aspect of China's plan that has really let them down.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to track even just registrations for minor soccer in Canada over the next couple of years to see what kind of an impact this may have at the grassroots level of kids now more than ever wanting to join soccer. Now, North America hosted across three countries, the US, Canada, and Mexico. How do you think they all did as hosts?
I think generally speaking, they did great. I mean, it was a bit uneven in terms of the number of games in each, but it was always going to be US heavy. There were some epic games in Mexico, and obviously, if you watch the game between Mexico and England, probably one of the great games of the tournament. I didn't get a chance to go to any of the games, but I think the reports, generally speaking, were positive for all three countries. And I think different cities, of course, have their different their different atmospheres and their vibes and their identities. FIFA obviously tries to make everything feel the same, and they rename the stadiums and all those sort of little silly details. But generally, I think they did well. The final was. I mean, it looked fantastic. It did. You know, some of those overshots, the overhead shots of you know, what we all know is Giant Stadium. Of course, we had to call it New York, New Jersey Stadium for the tournament. Looked spectacular, as did many of the other grounds as well. So, yeah, I think not really. I think they would all be pretty happy. It was nice to see the three leaders all at the final. Obviously, Trump is taking center stage. But it was nice to see the other ones there as well.
Literally and figuratively.
Let me just jump back in there. So the Club World Cup was held in the US last summer. So this is a club side competition. It's kind of like a warm-up event for the World Cup, and it was held in the US. Now, Chelsea won it, and Trump was on stage for the trophy lift. And there's this great shot of Cole Palmer, who's one of the best Chelsea players, didn't actually make the England squad, which was another talking point. But he's kind of looking at Trump going like, you know, what are you doing? Like, why are you on stage with us when we're lifting this trophy? And you could see the dynamics when there was the trophy lift with Spain. Infantino was kind of, you know, he had his moment on stage and then they were about to do the trophy lift. Infantino was trying to pull him off stage a little bit, but he knew that Trump kind of wanted to stay there. And then the Spanish team were also kind of looking around going like, has he gone yet? Has he gone yet? And then he was sort of on stage on the edge when they did the trophy lift. And that's important because that is the shot. That is the moment frozen in time. And so the question is, you know, is he just in or just out? But it was kind of was interesting to see, given the history of a year ago when they were like, you know what, this is about us, the players. This is no longer your thing. But, you know.
Thank God for Photoshop. Now, what about the chances of England hosting in the future?
Well, I think they're always going to be on the radar. So England is one of the co-hosts more immediately for the next Euros, which is going to be Euro 2028. So obviously every 2 years, you've got either a World Cup or a Euros, and in different continents, you know, the Copa America in South America and so on. So that is England, Scotland, Wales, and the Republic of Ireland in June and July 2028. So the World Cup, the next one is going to be, there's actually five different nations. And then in 2034, it's going to Saudi Arabia. So at some point, you know, England will come back on the skin, on the calendar, but I don't imagine it's going to be anytime soon.
Your Economist piece was widely read. And central theme is the underperformance of Chinese football relative to the investment and political will behind it. What is the state of the Chinese men's national team right now? And how do we possibly explain the persistent gap between ambition and results?
If I address that very last part first, the gap, I think the ambition, actually, the ambition that was there in 2015, it's hard to say it no longer exists, but it has very much taken a back seat. I think the powers that be at the very top have almost given up on the men's national team. And we talked about England hosting. It used to be a matter of time when China was going to host a World Cup. A lot of people were asking at the beginning of this tournament, why doesn't China host? It would be fantastic. It would be a brilliant host. It would have fantastic infrastructure. It would build everything it doesn't already have. The transportation and logistics would be absolutely world-class. You know, there'd be passion, there'd be fans who would embrace all the different teams. It would be fantastic. But my analysis of why China is not hosting, because Infantino used to visit China on a fairly regular basis. He used to meet with Xi Jinping. Now he meets with, you know, a deputy sports minister. The leadership doesn't want a World Cup in China because they would be humiliated by their own national team, in their estimation. Realistically, if China's playing and it's not getting out of the group stage, you know, they're not humiliated. They're not one of the strongest teams. It's a competitive tournament. But I think that performance on the pitch would negatively outweigh in the view of the leadership any benefits they get from hosting the tournament. Going back to the rest of the question, I mean, so it's really the political will that China had when they announced their plan to redevelop Chinese football in 2015 has largely disappeared, and that I think is sort of feeding into why they're not going to be hosting anytime soon. Certainly, I mean, the next time technically they could host it would be 2042. I mean, that's a long time from now. And who knows where China is, who knows where the world is, who knows where the game of football and even the World Cup is at that point. So, yes, there's a lot we could talk about, but things haven't been going well.
Now, what is the state of youth football development in China? Are the structural issues getting better or worse? And maybe explain what those structural issues could be for the listeners. And what would a genuine grassroots football culture actually require?
So grassroots football, it needs, you got to think of the whole system as a pyramid or a triangle where you've got just a mass of low level everyday participation at all levels, at all ages, at the base, and then it feeds up into sort of more professional. And then right at the top, you have the elite, you know, the national team or the professional teams. China doesn't have that base. So it doesn't have the foundation upon which everything builds. There's a bunch of reasons for this, but in all sports, not just in football, there is a massive drop off at around 12 or 13, because lots of Chinese parents want their kids to play sports when they're very young. But as soon as middle school exams kind of come into view and suddenly you're thinking about high school and then the university entrance exam, then they have to get serious. And basically football, with many other things like hobbies, are seen as a distraction. So unless they see that as a route to something, i.e. my kid is 12 and is really good at football and is going to be professional and this is what he's going to stick at, or she, then they generally drop it. How on earth are you going to tell if a 12-year-old kid is going to become professional? That's number one. Number two, if you look at the state of the national team, what parents actually want their kids to be playing in the Chinese national team as like, you know, and be the national humiliation through no fault of their own? It's the system's fault, not they're as good as the system allows them to be. And so that, I think, is the single biggest issue. There are other ones, but that's the single biggest issue, where we just don't have enough people playing. We need adults playing. They don't need to be professional, but we need, you know, Sunday league. If you go to any park in England, for example, on a Sunday or a Saturday, you see games of football being played. And this is structured, organized football, and they're in some sort of level. So they could be the 13th level of the pyramid. Now, technically speaking, if your village team gets promoted 12 years in a row, you're in the Premier League. It's obviously not going to happen, but the point is, it's all interconnected. In China, you have different government departments looking at different areas. So you have the sports ministry and they're looking at the elite level. Then you have the education department and they're looking at the schools. And then you have different things. You have like a tranche of university level sport, and that's a slightly different organization. And none of these things are connected in the way that they need to be. It's certainly not seamless. And they have different departments with different incentives. But the main thing is, you just don't have enough people playing. So you need that base of participation. And just think of it, without that foundation, the whole system collapses. And that's unfortunately what we have. I will try and offer some positives. China started its plan to improve Chinese football in 2015. So it's a 20-year plan. If you really start with the young kids who are five, you need to wait until they're 25 to see if they're going to succeed at the national team level. Now, the under-17 team recently got to the final of the under-17 Asian Cup, where they lost to Japan, which is a pretty good result. They also very nearly went out of the group stage, but managed to sneak through and then went on a bit of a run. So there is an argument that some people have said, well, look, in 10 years' time, these guys could be competitive. I'd love to see it happen. You know, I feel like for two decades I've almost been like a cheerleader for the Chinese sports industry, but I'm not holding my breath. There's too many other things that are not being addressed that really need to be addressed for China to be successful long term.
There is definitely the depression on teenagers coming from parents and grandparents to now focus on studies, because that is the one and only kind of path for most. Let's also look at North America, for example, because that's what I really know. And I'm interested on what you know about Europe, but the culture of being a university or a college athlete, the billions of dollars that is raised by the alma maters of the wealthy who went to certain universities and colleges and giving back and donating the scholarships. This is what pays for so many kids to be able to go to university. It's a great life. It's an admired life. Young athletes know at an early stage that there's a lot of cachet when you go to university if you're playing on one of the university's sports teams. And employers know that these are the types of youth that they want to hire when they graduate, because take how difficult university already is, and then add on having to be a student athlete at the same time. They admire the dedication. They admire that they've been able to be a team player, to follow game plans and to be coached, and, you know, to be fit and focus on health. And there's so many upsides. There's this entire culture in North America. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't exist in Europe. My sense is that it probably does, but that it is very nascent in Asia and in China specifically, where that really isn't a thing. And I think, and I'd like your thoughts on this, that that also depresses the amount of young potentials staying in the sport.
You're right. The different continents have very, very different systems. So, for example, you know, you've outlined how it works with North American sport and the universities and the scholarships, and that gives people a real goal to aim for, to get to university. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to go pro afterwards. In Europe, and I think largely in South America as well, you are scooped up by the professional clubs at a very young age. You're in their youth academies, and so you go through. So you're not going to university. You're signing senior terms the day you turn 16, if you're good enough. Up until then, you're on a kind of like a, you know, like an academy wage. And so it's quite different. And so because some of these players, you know, like Lamine Yamal, 19 and already a global star, he was obviously scouted, I don't know, but he was scouted at a very, very young age. And so he's been in the system of where there's a lot of money just for much earlier. Whereas in North America, the money sort of starts to come at that university, which is much, much later, probably a decade or more later. In China, you don't have the university scholarships. You have a much smaller elite sports infrastructure, given the number of people, for example. So going back to England, you have four professional leagues. And right now the National League, which is the fifth tier, is basically full-time professional. So that's, you know, 100 odd teams. In China, you've got the Chinese Super League and then, you know, a couple of leagues below that. So maybe 60 teams who are quote professional, but you've got, I don't know, 20 times the number of people. So the chances of you making it into one of those spots is very, very tough. I don't think that's going to change. The one thing I would pick up on what you were saying in terms of the family environment, and it's worth saying from a cultural point of view, is even though there is no longer a one-child limit, that policy was scrapped and they're now encouraging people to have two and even three children, the majority of kids today still are single children. And so that pressure to provide financially for your parents and for your four grandparents is massive. And there are more than 10 million graduates coming out of university every single year, all trying to get the same jobs. And so anything like football or sports or hobbies is seen, and I know I mentioned this before, but it's seen as a distraction to that main goal of providing for the family. And that's really tough. That's really tough for anyone but the sort of the upper middle classes to break out of.
It's a culture of pay it back, not pay it forward, like we have in North America. Our parents are generally already sorted. They have retirement. They have their pensions or their 401ks or what have you. They're looking forward to their children taking care of their children's children and so on. It is the exact opposite in a place like China. They've poured their heart and soul into the children so that the children can be successful, so that the children and their success can then take care of them when they're, you know, they age out of working age and are no longer able to, you know, have an income for themselves. I also think, going back to even looking at North America or Europe, first of all of the, with the universities and the colleges and the academies, and there's also a lot of jobs that are provided. There's just a lot more economy wrapped around sports in general across the board in North America and in Europe, as well as how many of our parents and our children's parents, you know, the youth parents, are athletes, were athletes, are still athletes, still playing a lot of sports. That is also a very different situation than what's going on in China, where most parents and grandparents, by a large margin, also never really played sports or athletics. It's if you are, let's say you even play hockey, there's not a neighborhood pickup game of street hockey going on that you can just kind of go and join either, because you're a little bit rare if you are any kind of athlete as well. So I think all of that is just, there's a broader infrastructure from a human side that is vastly different as well. Your thoughts?
I'm just trying to figure out which part to address. I mean, yeah, it is culturally very different. And going back to the grassroots participation, you know, you need people at all, like that. If I'm saying, well, you need people at all ages to be playing, well, why? What's that going to do for the national team? Well, it just creates, you know, if you see your parents going up, still playing pick up football or hockey or whatever it is, then you're more likely to do it, and you're more likely to go to games with your family. And it's just, it feeds and builds, and you see the progress that other countries have made. Like it's you're born with it in lots of Europe and lots of South America, and you know, you're pretty much assigned a team at birth because that's part of your family tradition and your local culture and so on. But you can develop that, as we've seen in North America. And it's been great. I mean, some of the viewing figures in the US for the World Cup final were staggering compared to what we've seen for the sport in previous years. And it pains me because there is a passionate fan base for the sport, for football in China, but most of them are armchair fans. And that's not saying you don't have to be good, but you just, you know, where's the there aren't the dads leagues, you know, there aren't the kind of, you know, all ages, all the pickups and so on. Exactly. I was down in South London about a month or so ago, and staying with some friends, and their kids play in a local league, and there was a Sunday fair, and there were hundreds and hundreds of kids from all the different age groups. They all play in local leagues. Some of them are much more competitive. Others are real beginners. But there's a place for everyone. They just want. It's all run by volunteers, largely, almost entirely. And they all just want their kids to be able to play, not because they need to become professional, just because it's fun and it's community. And, you know, we don't have any of that in China. It's very hard to see it changing, because that organic community support and growth is not something that really is possible in China, given the confines of the state. Nothing can really exist outside of the state in any kind of significant way. And once the state gets involved, then we kind of go back to this whole thing where you have non-footballing people making footballing decisions. And as we've seen over the last decade, that doesn't work.
Thanks, Mark, for indulging in this impromptu deep dive into culture. I do think it is really important. I don't think anything can be explained well about China at all without a touch of culture being involved. And it is important for those listening who are trying to understand China better, that how woven culture is into all things, even as we're talking about 12-year-olds playing soccer. Now, moving on, where does the Chinese Super League stand today?
Well, it's had its ups and downs over the years. Unfortunately, we're in a bit of a down. That's because for the 2026 season, there's the 16 teams in the Chinese Super League. 9 of them, more than half, started the season on negative points, less than 0 points, because they'd been given a whole raft of penalties for match fixing and corruption and gambling offences over the last few years. Now, on the plus side, it's good that they are cracking down on that. But it's hard to really engage in a league where it's not really about who's the best team and who's at the top. It's about who is managing their points differential better than the others. And so we've kind of had a bit of a mismatch. But, you know, for long-term fans, they still get to go and see their games and it's still playing. But yes, it's not, we've had this before. It feels like every, I don't know, decade or so, they kind of come down tough on match fixing and gambling and various corruption. It's all sort of, you know, different things, but all kind of linked. And, you know, why is it still happening? It's not the only country where it happens. Italy's had some massive scandals in the past, but it is a recurring theme. And you just kind of think, well, yes, you've cracked down on it. You've announced these penalties, but is it still happening? And unfortunately, when it happens with, you know, look at cycling in the Tour de France and all those years where you're watching it, just questioning, are these people doping? And it undermines the sport. And so right now in China, you've got, you know, if your team loses, maybe your goalie lets in a howler in the last minute, you're thinking, well, is he getting paid for that? You know, he's probably not. But the fact that you're asking that question is not a good situation for the sport to be in. So yeah, ups and downs. But unfortunately, we're in a bit of a down at the moment when it comes to the Super League.
I will admit the doping scandals at the Tour de France have. I am exactly that person you were talking about. I have just that turned my nose 20 years ago, whenever. And I used to watch it. I used to love it. And then I just couldn't anymore when it was too often, too many of my favorite cyclists. And I became disinterested. And I have, even in the last decade, not really cared or paid attention to it at all. And now that you reminded me of it, I do think that is quite a shame. And I should remind myself to revisit that. Let's talk about how the World Cup was received in China. Moreover, how it was consumed in China, because something fascinating happened on the media side. Xiao Hongshu secured the streaming rights for all 104 matches free of charge for users. How did that change the way Chinese fans consume the tournament? Obviously, streaming, okay. And what does it signal about the future of sports broadcasting in China?
Well, there's a few things to dig into here. So just for people who may not be familiar with Xiangshu, it's effectively China's Instagram. That's probably the nearest equivalent. So that would be unusual for a tournament to be streamed on something like that. But the Chinese sports broadcasting landscape has long been quite fragmented, and platforms will pop up, sometimes affiliates of parent companies, and suddenly they've got a huge big tournament and no one's ever heard of them before, but it doesn't really matter. It does sort of jump around a bit. And that's been the case for about 10 to 15 years, where there's new apps that will pop up and suddenly they're the major player, or they'll go bust or, you know, so it's a very fluid landscape, which is actually quite exciting because you got competition. And so there's lots of people bidding and trying to stream lots of things. So that's a good thing. It's getting it in front of the fans, and the fact that it was free of charge, also a positive. Now, it was obviously in North America, not a great time zone for Chinese viewers. And of course the Chinese team was not in it. So you really had to be passionate to be getting up often in the middle of the night, particularly in the later stages as the games get more exciting. Often it was 3 a.m. kickoffs, 5 a.m. kickoffs. I was in China for some of the England games, and, you know, you get up because it's England and it's once every 4 years. But if you're Chinese and you're sort of picking and choosing, like, it's a big ask to get up at 3 a.m. in the middle of it. It could be, you know, in the middle of the week, like you got a work day. So that was tough. Just before the World Cup, there was this real showdown between CCTV, the national state broadcaster, and, well, their parent group, China Media Group, so CMG, but basically it's all sort of the same conglomerate, and FIFA, because with a month to go, there was no broadcasting deal. Now, the way that it works, there is CMG technically have to sign the deal with FIFA. They have like that those exclusive rights, and then they sub-license it to Xiao Hongshu and or to other platforms if they want, and they show some games themselves. So it's a little bit of a mix. But the thinking was, because of those reasons, I was thinking no Chinese team, just a really difficult broadcast schedule for Asian fans and for Chinese fans. China didn't want to pay nearly as much as FIFA were asking. So there was this standoff, and then they finally got the deal done, and then it sort of turned around. So yes, great that it was distributed that way. But again, you're not going to have eye-popping numbers out of China just because of the time zone.
Okay. Now I have to talk about the Haaland phenomenon in China, because it was extraordinary. Talk about his celebrity status and other popular players in China.
Well, it's funny because, you know, Haaland, the Norwegian striker who showed up in a big way in the tournament. And I think from what I could tell from afar, it was sort of similar to the, you know, to the breakout that he had in North America too, particularly in the US. You know, I was reading about people saying, you know, my mom now knows who he is. Like, that's the level of fame he's achieved in the US. And I guess the fact that he was a brand ambassador for so many brands in China kind of saw it coming, because they had to sign him up ahead of the tournament. And then it was a bit more organic. It helped that the Norway team did so well. It helped that they have this kind of iconic row and the chants and the claps that people really identify with, and the fans were so special. But again, getting deep into the tournament, and he turned up and scored a bunch of goals. But yes, he was a pitch man, a brand ambassador for a bunch of things. Probably not at the same level of Messi. Messi has been all over Chinese billboards for a long, long time. He's it's cult like status. When Argentina played Australia 2-3 years ago in Beijing in the summer, it was just a friendly. It was absolute bedlam. I happened to be around the corner from where his hotel, where him and the team were arriving from the airport, and it was thousands of people, just chaos. They ended up having to take them in the back door because I think there would have been there would have been a stampede type thing if they had to cancel a bunch of public appearances when Messi was there. And the tickets for the games were impossible to get. There were tens of thousands of people just in Messi shirts outside the stadium, just turning up for the atmosphere. That's how big it was. I mentioned that because, you know, that's the next level. But Haaland is sort of now, I would say, a tier below that. And he's so young. Messi is 39. He's had that visibility for so, so long. And there's almost, you know, most of the major brands in China have been affiliated with Messi at one point. Haaland is just beginning. So yes, those are the two, I would say, the two standouts from this World Cup. I will tell you a great story. It's one of my favorite China sports stories. And this goes back to Ronaldo, but not Cristiano Ronaldo, the Brazilian Ronaldo from the sort of the late 90s was when he was at his peak. And he was very popular in China at the time. And he came over for some sort of promotional, I forget the exact details, but he came over for some kind of promotional assignment. And there was a dinner where you could have your, you know, you could pay to have dinner with Ronaldo and pay to have your photo taken with him. And one of the guys, a very enterprising businessman, posed for a photo, a still photo, with Ronaldo after this dinner, and said, "Yo, can you hold this thing?" And it was some kind of product. And Ronaldo was like, "Sure," like he's just put it in my hand. And they kind of filmed a few seconds of video and then turned that into a 30-second commercial, which ran for years on Chinese television. And it was not authorized. And Ronaldo, so the story goes, was furious and didn't come back to China for years after that, because he was like, "I'm not going to sign a deal because they're going to scam me." It was just this one guy who, you know, it was like I said, quite enterprising. But it was quite funny that this dinner turned into like a full-length commercial. You could not get away with that these days. I think, you know, Haaland and Messi and their teams would have everything buttoned down pretty tightly. But yeah, it's always makes me smile remembering that story.
You've covered Chinese football for nearly two decades and written the definitive English language book on China's sporting ambitions. What is the single most important thing that needs to change for Chinese football to genuinely improve? And do you think it's actually possible?
So there's two answers I'm going to give to this. I think the biggest thing would be to have Chinese football exist, you know, have the Chinese FA, which technically it's supposed to be separate from the government. It's actually one of FIFA's statutes that there can't be political interference in football. But the Chinese FA, the Football Association, is part of the sports ministry. It reports directly. Like, you can't have more political interference than that. But so the first thing I would say is for it to be truly independent, then you could have football people making football decisions. You could have long-term horizons rather than government horizons, which is sort of 3 to 4 year cycle, looking for a promotion and a quick win where they're just trying to do something short and sharp. But I'm going to stop there because I don't see that practically happening in the system. I just don't think that that is possible. So that is what needs to happen, but it won't. There is one thing that I think could conceivably happen, which would make a big impact. I think it's kind of unlikely, but let me just, you know, go with me on this. We talked about this cliff of youth sports at sort of 12, 13. If they were to try to somehow allow sporting credit to be part of the university curriculum, or if you could maybe, you know, play football and get 20% of your grade going into the Gaokao, which is the university entrance exam, then there would be an actual route for, you know, football wouldn't be dismissed as a distraction, as a hobby, as something that is taking away from our academics, from our study. If they were somehow able to incorporate that or allow that to be incorporated, and you can get credit in football or in sports as an academic credit, if that makes sense as an idea, then I think we could see people playing for another 5-6 years and then potentially into adulthood. I think that would get people over the line, but you just grow that base of participation, and that is what fundamentally is missing. So again, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. I haven't heard talk. It's just kind of my crazy idea, but it is conceivable in the way that this, you know, let's redefine the political nature of China idea is obviously that's not going to happen. So let's talk about something that is possible.
And something the parents would get behind, the Gaokao loophole.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And you know, from 2 decades in China, there's nothing that Chinese love more than the loophole, whether it's a big or a small one. I mean, the ways to and I mean that in a nice way. It's kind of like figuring out, OK, here's a roadblock. Where do I go? How do I get around this problem? I think that would be I would certainly encourage it. Maybe I should start a campaign.
Yeah. OK, I like it. Mark, fantastic conversation. For listeners who want to follow your coverage of Chinese sport, where can they find you?
Well, my podcast that I kind of had is on a little bit of hiatus because it was sort of still in the post-COVID dip. But look for me on Twitter, X, Dryer China is probably the best. And I also have a Substack, China Sports Insider. Stay tuned. Hopefully we've got some new things to announce soon.
And go buy the book and read the book, Sporting Superpower. Mark Dreyer, founder of China Sports Insider, author of said book, Sporting Superpower. Thanks very much for joining us on the Negotiation Podcast today. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Todd. Always fun to come on.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We really appreciate you guys jumping in and listening to this conversation today. If you don't mind, go ahead, hit the like, hit the subscribe, maybe even hit the download button. Who does that? Everybody streams nowadays. Come on. But we'd really appreciate any interaction or any time. And speaking of interacting, if you want to get in touch with us, hit us up at podcast@wpic.co. Let us know what you think. If you have any guest recommendations, we'd love those too. But we'd always love to hear from everybody. Really appreciate that. But for me, from Mark, and from everybody at The Negotiation, thank you very much for listening and or watching. And we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.